Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. If you don't care about keeping your teeth, your general health, or bad breath, this edition of Radio Curious is not for you. Our guest is Dr. John Knapp, a retired professor from the University of California at San Francisco School of Dentistry, recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on July 16, 2010. We began when I asked him the overall effect of poor oral health.
Right now, we're finding, and over the last 10 or 15 years, we've been finding that there's a very strong relationship between periodontal health, for instance, and diabetes, the same relation to heart disease, preterm births, lower or increased mortality among those having kidney dialysis. So all of these issues are starting to bring the head back to the body where it hasn't been for quite some time.
So when you say periodontal health, mm-hmm. that's cavities, gum disease, loss of teeth.
No, it's not cavities. It's not cavities. It's the bone and supporting structures around the teeth. So cavities are also caused by an infection, a bacterial infection, but it requires food and other things to be around for that to happen. So the two main diseases in dentistry that we treat are tooth decay or caries and periodontal disease. There are cancers and other things, but they're a small portion of what we do compared to those two. So tooth decay primarily affects young people.
By young, you mean up to age 20?
I would say up to age 20. It doesn't mean you can't get tooth decay later, but the predominant population that gets it is there. So, and tooth decay requires a few things. Obviously, it requires teeth, but it also requires poor hygiene, usually, and poor diet. So those things are always put together. So we always think about how you protect those teeth. And certainly, one of the major pieces in that is nutrition. There will be a discussion of fluoride, which is intended to harden the surfaces of some of those teeth. And then sealants, which is a plastic coating that we generally put on newly erupted molars in children, sometimes other teeth, but primarily newly erupted molars. And we're hoping that that buys time until the teeth are fully calcified and sealed. So that those two measures together prevent a lot of root caries or tooth decay, but not in everybody. And there's some genetic predisposition to getting tooth decay. So we still need to keep an eye on things, and that's where brushing and flossing comes in. And toothbrushing takes care of all the surfaces usually you can see, and the flossing takes care of the part of the teeth that are blocked out. They're between the teeth. So right now, the general recommendation based on the research is if you brush and floss your teeth very thoroughly once a day, you'd probably be in good shape.
What does very thoroughly mean to the average mouth?
Well, I guess there's two parts to that. One of them is the amount of time, and the second part is technique. I've found the last several years I've been actually providing mostly periodontal and oral medicine services at one of the clinics here, and I've been focusing a lot on brushing technique. And it turns out that most people do not brush effectively to prevent either tooth decay or periodontal disease. Usually it's a quick and fast brush and you miss a lot of areas, and sure enough, those will be the areas you get tooth decay in.
So quick is how short versus adequate being how long?
Well, when I first started out teaching people how to brush properly, and some of them are always stunned that this is a different way, it's different than what they were taught when they were young, I start out having them brush without toothpaste for the time between two TV commercials at night, which is about 10 minutes. And eventually, when their technique is down and they've got it, you know, a minute and a half, 2 minutes is really good. But 2 minutes seems like a long time in our society. You know, people are not patient enough usually to do it for 2 minutes. But if you do it thoroughly and you do it systematically, you will be pretty effective in the way you brush. And we see patients turn around their dental health all the time when they take control of it and make that kind of a commitment to it.
Do you have thoughts about the electric or battery-powered toothbrushes that do different things than the ones moved by hand alone?
Well, you know, when they first came out, I was not a real fan of it because it took people away from any good technique. But I got over that. And certainly the last 10 or 15 years, usually what I'll do is ask the patient to bring their brush with them, and I'll show them that technique with an electric brush. And so it can be done with an electric brush. You know, they're the sonic type brushes or the rotary brushes. As long as they're soft tips, they will work very well with that kind of brushing technique. So I think where they're really handy. Now, we're obviously, you know, Americans are in love with gadgets and technology. But where I first started using them was with patients who had severe arthritis or other problems holding a brush, and sometimes dexterity problems holding a brush. And in those cases, the electric brush is like a savior for those people.
Well, many of those people are of a more advanced age than the younger ones, the under 20 group that we were mentioning, who seem to me could be the ones who could learn the technique for proper dental care and brushing in particular.
Yeah, I think that's true. Part of the problem is knowledge seems to filter very slowly through the professions. And the technique that I use and a lot of dentists use who are very interested in both periodontal things and long-term prevention is called a BAS technique or a modified BAS technique. And it was invented, I think, sometime after World War II. I don't remember exactly, by a guy named Charles Bass, a dentist, who was very interested in his whole feeling was that you could save teeth. Because up till then, they were doing a lot of pulling out the teeth and making dentures. So he developed this particular technique. And there are other techniques. But I have found in my use of these different techniques that this Bass technique is by far and away the most effective over the long term. Yeah, it's what it really involves is holding a toothbrush at about a 45-degree angle to your gums. So it partially rests against your teeth and your gums. And then you move it in a very slow back-and-forth motion, very gentle motion.
Perpendicular to the way the teeth are growing.
It's actually at a 45-degree angle.
But
so
I'm talking about the motion.
Oh, yeah, the motion, yeah, would be perpendicular to it. So you're basically giving your gums a massage, and what you're doing is removing any debris that are in the pockets around the teeth. So it's a very effective technique, and sometimes people need a little help getting there because some areas of the mouth are hard to reach. But once they realize they can do it, they don't look in a mirror anymore to brush their teeth. They do it all by feel, and many patients will come back and say, "My mouth has never felt this good." So to be able to do that with just a brush, no toothpaste, just a soft toothbrush and a little change in technique is a very positive thing in terms of prevention and people feeling good about what's going on in their mouth.
What is the importance of toothpaste versus tooth powder versus nothing?
Well, toothpaste is used a lot of different ways, and it's been used to put fluoride on teeth. In fact, at Indiana, they developed the first, where I graduated from dental school, they developed the first formula that worked on teeth, stannous fluoride for Crest. So there are those particular things. There are some that help interfere with plaque formation on the teeth. But I think most often people use it for flavor and for the taste in their mouth. Probably the thing that it's been used a lot for, which I think is probably the worst thing to use it for, is to remove stains on your teeth. So people who are smokers, heavy coffee drinkers, frequently build up a little stain, which doesn't build up very much if your hygiene's really good. But if it is just mediocre, it'll build up. So they'll get an abrasive toothbrush or a paste because they want white teeth. So there used to be... I won't go into brands, so I don't impugn anybody. But there were several brands out that really were based on whiter teeth. Now the whitening has gone more to these strips and other chemicals, actually, like peroxides, to whiten teeth and going away a little bit from the abrasive toothpaste because they do cause damage to your teeth over a lifetime.
So you recommend using toothpaste, tooth powder? A few minutes ago, you were talking about teaching people how to brush without using a paste or a dentifrice.
Yeah, I think I would say that it's certainly an individual matter.
So it doesn't matter so much.
It doesn't really matter. I think if your brushing technique is good, and just from my own experience with it, I think most of the time brushing without toothpaste is really not a bad idea. Your real removal of debris is happening with the bristles, the soft bristles of the toothbrush.
You mentioned soft bristles.
Mm-hmm.
Those are preferred to medium or hard bristles?
Yes.
Why?
You know, on a radio show, you can't show the damage that a hard bristle does.
But you can create an image in someone's...
I'll try to create an image. So what many people have is they'll find almost wedge-shaped notches at the bottom of their teeth. And what those are from is usually brushing with a hard bristle toothbrush or even a medium bristle toothbrush. And some people, because this is the way they were taught or the way they grew up or the way they absorbed the lesson, they think the harder you do it, the better. And it turns out that's not true. If you're not a real good brusher and you develop plaque, which is the soft deposits that bacteria create from any food debris, or it turns into calculus, which is a hard deposit on your teeth, you're not going to get it off with a toothbrush anyway. You're going to need help from someone like me to get that off, or a hygienist. So a soft brush, what it really does is it dislodges what's going on in the pockets of the teeth, and it stimulates the blood flow to the gums, which is generally a healthy situation. Because what happens in periodontal disease, for instance, which is what I do more of these days, is in the pockets of the teeth, if the food debris is left there, the bacteria start working on it. And bacteria vary from person to person. Some people have more aggressive bacteria than others do. But the same principle holds. So if there's food debris, you start to get a little inflammation down there. If that inflammation stays around, one of the body's responses is to remove bone. In essence, that's periodontal disease. So what you're trying to do is remove some of that debris so the bacteria don't have anything to start working on to the point where you have inflammation down there.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Dr. John Knapp, who was on the faculty of the University of California at San Francisco School of Dentistry. He led the development of the school's first comprehensive faculty practice and the first group practice oriented in a pre-doctoral clinic curriculum. He's now somewhat retired, lives and works near Ukiah in Mendocino County, California. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. John, the fear of dentists seems to exist in many, if not most people. And I presume that you have some ideas about where that comes from, and perhaps it's the pain in opening your mouth, a very intimate part of the body, to a stranger.
Well, yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons we have that. I'm not sure about you, but I had enough painful experiences when I was young growing up in Chicago.
It didn't deter you.
It didn't make me think about dentistry until I was much older. I had a funny reaction. I had plenty of tooth decay, and I had a funny reaction to injections, the Novocaine, which they use, then we don't use that anymore. But it wasn't so much the injection that bothered me, but I would get something called trismus, and which is a tightening or hardening of the muscles. So whatever muscle the injection went through, I would probably get, my guess is probably a little hemorrhage or a little hematoma in the muscle. And for the next couple of days, I'd have trouble opening my mouth more than maybe the width of a finger. So it was something that I finally decided was worse than white knuckling and dealing with the pain without anesthesia. So until I went to dental school, from the time I was, I think I was about 8, until I went to dental school when I was 30, I had plenty of fillings and none of them with anesthesia. So it just got to be something that from my stoic upbringing that I just accepted. But we see patients every day who come in scared to death. They're mostly afraid of the injections. They're less afraid of what we're going to do beyond that.
So for people who may be afraid of the injections, can the pain, which promotes the fear, be eliminated and people feel comfortable?
Well, I would say 99.9%. I mean, there's always some exceptions to this rule, but I think these days we have a lot of tools to make the whole process more comfortable for patients. And many patients will say after they've been to the clinic, I don't know why I waited so long to do this. Of course, they're in trouble by this point, but it's like it wasn't so bad once I finally got here. It was the thinking about it. You know, it's the thinking about what's going to happen, the apprehension that is the majority part of the problem. I had a patient the other day who came in, and he was afraid I was going to give him an injection, but I use some other, I don't always give patients injections for what I do, but I have some topical things that I can use to make it more comfortable. And when he was done, it was like I was dealing with two different people. When he came in, he was very, very difficult to deal with because he was afraid. When he left, he was so relaxed. He's shaking my hand and thanking me. And, you know, he's so relieved that, it, you know, that we did all this. But that is not an uncommon experience in dentistry today. So many times the fears come from the parents. So we have kids coming in who are afraid, who have never even been there. So the parents, we almost try to keep the parents out of the room with the children so that we can get the child dealt with and comfortable in the environment. Because all the parent has to do is open their mouth and say, it won't hurt too much. And that's, and your game is over.
How little is too much?
How little is too much? So from that point on, you rarely have a real cooperative patient. So the idea now actually is to get children in when they're about 6 months old or when their first teeth start to pop through. And not that we're going to do anything much on them except make sure that things are okay. Look at the soft tissues in their mouth, get them used to someone looking at them, and make it a very pleasant experience early on. And we also use that now to educate the parents, because we have many parents who do not understand that you don't put a child to bed with a bottle that has Kool-Aid in it or milk. You know, water maybe, but nothing else. And they don't know that. They their own traditions have been disrupted. Some of them are immigrants to this country. Some of them are Native Americans, particularly where we work, and or they come from very poor families, and they just do not have that information.
So what's the problem with milk or Kool-Aid?
Well, I'll start with Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid is a lot of sugar and water, and one of the best ways to develop dental caries is with sugar. And the bacteria working on it overnight in a child's mouth, it's just a tremendous field for the bacteria to develop and cause a problem. In milk, people don't realize it, but milk has lactic acid and lactase, which is another sugar. So between those two, it's a very fertile area for bacteria to grow. And so we have the same problem. So what we end up seeing, if we don't see these children early, we get early childhood caries. They used to call it baby bottle tooth decay. And it's extremely hard to treat a really young child when you have to try to restore, you know, almost all of their teeth, or many of their teeth are so bad that they have to be removed. So in those cases, now, fortunately, we have some places that we can send them. But a young child will have to be anesthetized, fully anesthetized to do this kind of work. So we have worked since I've been up here. I started working in the clinics up here in 96, and it took us, I would think probably looking back now, 10 years, we finally developed the Pediatric Dental Initiative with Lake County and Sonoma County. And so we have a place down near Windsor that we can send some of these children to get them treated, especially if we can put the financial packages together to get that done. And we have no pedodontist in this county, so we still have to send people to Santa Rosa for that kind of care.
When a young child is given something to drink, like milk, before bed, would you recommend that there be a rinse or that there be a bottle with water or
brush their teeth? I mean, rather than let something, especially if it's immediately before they're going to bed, I would say at least brush their teeth.
And if they're very young, developing the habit, babies without teeth yet?
Well, you know, if they don't have any teeth yet, they're not going to have tooth decay. If the teeth are not erupted, they won't have tooth decay.
But a habit is being developed.
Exactly. It's a habit. So it's, the earlier you can get out of that habit, the better. So, but if some teeth are erupting and you're not ready to brush them yet, you know, the mother or the father can always take a piece of gauze and dampen it with water and just gently wipe around those teeth for the child. So there's a lot of little things you can do that would help prevent the early tooth decay.
So dental health care is expensive, but it's not readily available to many people. What do we do about that?
Well, you know, it's interesting that there seem to be two populations that have access to dental care, and it's very much the same issue that goes on in medical care. You either are in the middle class or upper and you have insurance or enough money to take care of yourself, or you're very poor and you fall into Medicaid. And everyone in between gets left out. And I think the only way we're going to see a significant change is at some point when the country takes responsibility for delivery of health care, which is probably a whole huge topic all on its own. But dentistry, one of the problems with dentistry, and I think one of the things that you and I had discussed before this interview, was that dentistry has been, for political and historical reasons, has been kept pretty separate from the rest of medicine. And there are some changes in the works, even with what Obama has done for all the shortcomings of the current health reform. There have been some moves to improve access for children. And they, some of them will only kick in over the next few years. They're not all instantaneous. Trying to make more, and also trying to make more children who are eligible for Medicaid, get them in, make sure they get care. There's been a number of studies that show a sort of a delinkage, that if a child's parents don't have medical insurance, they tend not to get dental care. So there's definitely a linkage. So it's not only a linkage in the way things are financed and accessed, it's also there's a linkage in health. And I think those particular linkages need to encourage us to have a more cohesive and comprehensive healthcare reform.
So what is a person to do who is not in one of the two categories that you mentioned, those with insurance or those who qualify for Medicaid?
Well, I think right now there's probably a limited number of options. I think the first one is learn to take care of your mouth as best you can, because obviously the best you can do for yourself is not have to go to the dentist and get something major done. If you're going just for cleanings and a regular exam, that's not usually outrageously expensive, and at least you're current in what's going on.
That's a couple of $100 a year.
Probably, yeah. So that, I would say focus first on prevention and getting up to date.
Which is brushing and flossing.
It is brushing and flossing and having a hygienist help you in case you're missing some areas or get out areas that need to be, that may need special attention. So, you know, many patients have periodontal disease, and one of the ways which is a chronic disease, and one of the ways we maintain them is through regular cleanings. So I think learning to take care of yourself on a prevention level is number one. Number two is if you're talking to a dentist and they say that you need crown or fillings or bridge, talk to them about how soon they're needed, how urgent they are, work out plans, because right now there is no real easy way. Many dental practices allow you to put stuff on credit cards. They have pay plans, but that doesn't solve the problem if you don't have the money to pay it off ultimately.
It solves the bank's problem because they get a lot of interest on the credit card.
Well, it solves the dentist's problem because they get their money right away. So, yeah, it solves everybody's problem except the patient. So right now, we don't have a lot of good solutions for that.
Well, Dr. John Knapp, I want to thank you for being with us on Radio Curious, and talk more soon about what happens in the mouth and to the rest of the body if we don't have good dental care, resulting from cavities, resulting from periodontal problems, resulting from loss of teeth. But before we go there, I'd like to conclude this interview by asking you about a eureka moment.
One that comes back to me in 1973, in the fall of 73, I was taking a physical chemistry course. And the professor was describing the physical nature of atoms and molecules. So you start from this chemistry and you're looking at, you know, carbon this and nitrogen that and all, and how they're connected. But it turns out that when you're looking at that, there's more space than there is really matter. And the only thing that keeps things solid, you know, like the chairs we're sitting on, is electrical forces. And so the sense of something being solid or the sense of something being liquid is a matter of energy as opposed to matter. And I sat there kind of stunned listening. For some reason, this just hit me in the evening. I'd been reading things like Carlos Castaneda and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, so I'm thinking about this, and all of a sudden, I raised my hand and I asked him, I said, so you're telling us that nothing is what it appears to be to us in this room? And he says, that's absolutely right. it was one of those moments that that just kind of moves you to a different way of thinking about the world.
So at some other time, I'd like to visit with you about how things are really as opposed to how they appear.
Okay, we'll do that.
But what I'd like to know now is, what would you like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
I don't have any great ambitions, nor do I think I'm going to make huge changes in the world. But I would like to finish some writing that I've started. And one of them is, of course, on oral health. Not all of them, though. And I continue, as long as my health allows me, to be of service, you know, to be involved in the community. I love where I live. I love the people I'm around. And I'm hoping, as long as I can stay healthy, that I can keep doing that.
And can you tell us about an interesting book that you would recommend?
One of my favorite books that I've revisited twice, and thinking about that, I may be looking at it again, is a book called Mystics and Zen Masters by Thomas Merton. I don't know if you're familiar with Thomas Merton, but he was a Trappist monk who was a convert to Catholicism. And he was in a monastic community for many years and had a very strong voice on social issues, even though he was supposed to be a cloistered monastic. But over the course of his life, he came to the conclusion that the purpose of most religions was to get closer to God. Then he came across, because he was kind of open-minded to new things, he came across Buddhism. And he got very interested in Zen Buddhism. And just before he died, he was very much in contact with Zen masters and other Buddhists, looking at the connections, and realized that the more formal theocratic religions were not the only way to reach some of these experiences. It's not an easy read, I will tell you that. I read it over a period of 4 weeks, a little bit at a time, because that's all I could absorb the first time I read it. But it's an excellent book, and I think it was one of the last ones he wrote before he died.
Dr. John Knapp, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you.
Dr. John Knapp is a retired professor of dentistry at the University of California at San Francisco School of Dentistry. The book that he recommends is Turning Point, Science and Society and the Rising Culture by Fritjof Capra. This interview with Dr. John Knapp was recorded in the studios of Radio Curious on July 16, 2010. And remember, the only teeth you need to floss are the ones you want to save. There are over 380 Radio Curious archive editions on our website at radiocurious.org, where all programs are free to download, copy, share, or rebroadcast as you wish. We'd like you to use the whole program and ask that you give credit to Radio Curious. You may also subscribe to our podcast and receive new programs as they are produced. Click the podcast link at radiocurious.org. Let us know if you need a CD. We can make one for you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail may be sent to Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnested is our associate producer. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.